Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure that you go to 1517.org and peruse all the other things that we're doing. We got events that are happening all the time. We have speakers out and about, probably one coming somewhere near you. You can go check that out. We have conferences. Check those out. We have got articles and videos. We have videos of past conferences, all kinds of stuff. I mean, you can spend days and days and days and never exhaust all the content over at 1517. Thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of content. And so if you're wondering what the scriptures have to say about a certain thing, or if you've got some verse that you're trying to understand, there's a decent chance that we've wrote about it, talked about it, podcast about it. So you can go and find out some stuff. Chad, we ended last week in 1 Kings 16 in kind of an awkward spot. It wasn't any good news going on, which is, you know, not strange for the book of 1 Kings. But we got a bad prophecy for a guy who's gonna, you know, get eaten in the street like a dog, or by dogs, and or maybe he'll die in the field and get picked apart by birds. And that's kind of where we left it. So we got any good news today?
I think so. Maybe not immediately, but we got some coming up. I can't wait to actually get to the end of this chapter, only because chapter 17 is going to take us into the life ministry of Elijah, which is always fun.
That's going to get fun.
Yeah. So if the material, so if you've been listening to this and you're thinking, man, we just go from king to king to king to king. It's, you know, relatively predictable. This guy sinned. This bad thing happened to him. His son reigned, but he sinned. This bad thing happened to him. It seems like it's extremely repetitive and predictable. If that is your impression, well, congratulations. You've kind of got the message. In fact, that is what the narrator is trying to get across, is that all these guys are walking the same path of destruction. It's not the straight and narrow, but it's the broad. It's a broad way that's going to destruction. Every single time, all of them are walking the same path, falling off the same cliff over and over. So we're gonna take ourselves through the end of chapter 16. And then once we get past that, then we're going to focus on something a little bit different. We're going to begin to see how God is going to use the ministry of Elijah and then his successor, Elisha, which will take us all the way through 2 Kings chapter 13. So beginning with the next chapter, we're going to be introduced to these two prophets whose lives and ministries will actually encompass a large part of 1 and 2 Kings. But before we do that, we got to get through this list of kings here so we can understand the predictability of their sins and the punishment. So verse 5 through 7 of 1 Kings 16 basically just wraps up the end of Baasha. So this is the rest of the acts of Baasha, what he did, his might. Are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Baasha sleeps with his fathers. He's buried at Tirzah. Tirzah, at this point, is serving as the capital city of the northern kingdom. We're going to find out in a few verses that under the reign of a guy named Omri, it's going to move. It's going to move from Tirzah to the capital we are more familiar with, Samaria. But we're not there yet, right now at Tirzah. So Baasha dead, Elah, his son, reigns in his place. And then it says, moreover, the word of the Lord came by the prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha and his house, both because of all the evil that he did in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger with the work of his hands, in being like the house of Jeroboam, and also because he destroyed it. So this is this pattern of a prophet is sent by God. He speaks against this wicked king, and what the prophet prophesies comes to pass. So we move now from Baasha, who is the third king of the northern kingdom. We had Jeroboam, then we had Nadab, and now we have Baasha. We're going to move to Baasha's son, so the fourth king in the northern kingdom, whose name is Elah. So in the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, so this is this alignment we have where every time a king in the north takes the throne, his year of taking the throne is coordinated with the certain such a year of the king in the south, and then also the reverse of that if a king in the south takes the throne. So 26th year of Asa, king of Judah in the south, Elah, the son of Baasha, begins to reign over Israel in Tirzah, and he's got a pretty short reign. not as short as another guy we're going to see in a minute, but pretty short, 2 years. That's it. Why? What happened to it? His servant Zimri, who was commander of half of his chariot. So this is some sort of military leader. I don't know if that was a, like an official designation, half of the chariot leader, but he's the guy over half of the chariots, conspires against him. So Baasha is tying one on, basically. He's at Tirzah. We're told he's drinking himself drunk in the house of a so-called Arza. So here's this king who is three sheets to the wind. He's drunk. And Zimri comes in and just takes him out, strikes him down, kills him. No doubt the easiest, what's that word for killing a king?
Assassination?
Yeah. Regicide or something like that. Yeah, no doubt. A very easy murder taking place here because the guy's wasted. Zimri comes in, kills him, and then basically takes the throne in his place. So that king had a pretty short reign, 2 years. He's assassinated. Zimri takes over. This is going to be the back and forth that we see all through the Northern Kingdom. You know, you barely get a dynasty established. Maybe it's a son, maybe it's a grandson, and there's a coup, there's an assassination, somebody else takes over. So now Zimri is king, if we can call him that. So he begins to reign, and as soon as he gets on the throne, what does he do? Well, he does the same thing that's going to happen in other cases, and it has already happened. He takes out the competition. He murders all of the male relatives, and we're even told the friends of the king that he just assassinated. Of course, because if you leave a son, well, that son might be raised in secret somewhere. He's going to come later on when he's 18 or 20 or whatever, and he's going to try and take the kingdom away from you. So what do? You wipe out the competition. So Zimri murders not only the king, but he goes on to take out all the males of that guy's relatives, including his friends. So Zimri destroys all the house of Baasha. Now, he did this, of course, out of completely sinister, murderous, selfish motives. But he also, in doing it, we're told, fulfilled the word of the Lord, which he spoke against Baasha by Yehu the prophet. So this, again, is the same pattern where God says it's going to happen, and it does happen. And how does it happen? It happens by the hands of sinful men. In this case, Zimri is the guy who does it.
Yeah, but you see this a lot. I think maybe the best example where this is like really spelled out of how this works is in the book of Habakkuk, which we'll get to years from now. We'll get there. So this won't be this will be new again to you when I say this. But God tells Habakkuk, "Hey, check it out. I'm going to send the Assyrians," and Habakkuk's like, "What?
What?" Yeah, the Assyrians, like, yeah, the worst.
Yeah, like, wait a minute. Like, so you don't like what your people are doing, so you're going to send people that are arguably worse than them? What does that mean? It means that God is like, hey, I'm going to use wicked people to make a point here. They're going to bring about, and of course, what the Assyrians do was prophesied as well, and that's how it comes about. And so even to the people of that day, to the prophets, like sometimes it's shocking that this is the way it goes. But God can deliver a word, and that word is often carried out by unrighteous people.
And usually what follows that is those unrighteous people, whether the Babylonians or the Assyrians or whoever, are themselves then punished for what they did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what happens. God says, I'm going to use these wicked, bad, horrible people, Babylonians, Assyrians, whoever. And then he's going to turn around and punish them for what they did, so that there is justice in that respect.
Yeah, it's not as though this dude going out and murdering a guy's entire family and all his friends that God's like, that's exactly what I like to see. No, obviously that's all evil and wicked. It's just something that God knows is going to happen when you dabble in a bunch of idolatry. And there's and people have turned their back on God. This is the sort of thing that happens.
Yeah, yep. If you have idolatry, expect to see death all around you. And that is the inescapable impression that we get from all of this.
Yep.
What are they doing? We're told in verse 13. There, we've seen this repeatedly, provoking the Lord God of Israel to anger with their idols. Now, in the last episode, we talked about these pejorative words for idols. I think one was referred to as a horror that the Queen Mother had made. We also saw the dung deities referred to. This is another insulting word against idols. This one is a little bit tamer. The word here is hevel, which is the word that we encounter in the book of Ecclesiastes, where we read about vanity of vanities, which is havel havelim. So the word here would be something like God, they provoked God to anger with their vanities, I suppose. In fact, some translations might even render it that way. So hevel is like vapor, breath, vanity. So these idols, in other words, are emptiness, nothingness, we might say. So they're worshiping that which is nothing. And when they, that which they sow to nothing, they will also reap. So they themselves will resemble that which they worship, as G.K. Beale puts it. You resemble what you revere, either for your ruin or restoration. And we see that, of course, over and over in the history of Israel. And that wraps up that particular guy. Now we're gonna shift here to his usurper, the one who assassinated him, Zimri. And if you thought that the guy he assassinated had a short reign, 2 years, well, you ain't seen nothing yet. This guy's going to last a whopping 7 days. So it's the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, when Zimri, the usurper, reigned for 7 days in Tirzah.
Is that even long enough to be a king? I mean, is there a process that you need to go through that can be complete that? I mean, a week?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, it doesn't even count if it doesn't at least last a month.
Yeah, you're just a usurper at that point. I don't know if you ever really reigned.
Yeah, what are you gonna do? I mean, we are that's one of the funny things here, because skipping ahead a little bit, this guy who only reigns a week and is killed, it says that he also did evil in the sight of the Lord, walked in the ways of Jeroboam, made Israel to sin. So this guy who only lasts a week, he basically follows the same pattern as the people that came before him. So when he assassinated the king, the army was encamped at this place called Gibbethon, which is a Philistine city. And the troops heard what had happened. Zimri has conspired, they were told, and has killed the king. So they're away, basically, besieging this Philistine city. When word reaches them, hey, there's been a coup. Zimri, the guy that was in charge of half the chariots, he stepped in when the king was drunk, killed him. He's on the throne now. So what do they do? Well, the Israelites who were there said, we don't want that guy to be our king. We don't want Zimri to be our king. We want Omri, who is the commander of the army. He's the general. We want him to be king over Israel. So they basically put the crown on his head. So now we got two kings. You got Zimri, who usurped the throne. You got Omri, General Omri. We'll talk more about him in a minute, who is made king by the army. So now you got to figure out, well, you got two kings, you got to figure out who's going to be the real king. So that happens very quickly. Omri goes from this Philistine city, takes his army with him, and they besiege the capital city of Tirzah, where Zimri is hanging out. Zimri is, you kind of get the impression he just like, he's on his the palace roof watching what's happened. And when he realized the city is taken, he says, you know what? I'm not going to be taken. I'm going to make sure that I die in my own self-chosen way. So he goes into the citadel of the king's house. And what does he do? He pours gasoline all over everything, sets the place on fire, more or less. Burns the king's house over him with fire and died. And that then we have in verse 19, that passage I referred to a couple minutes ago, because of his sins that he committed, doing evil in the sight of the Lord, walking in that Jeroboam way, making Israel to sin. And then, verse 20 is almost humorous. Now the rest of the acts of Zimri and the conspiracy that he made, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? I can't imagine there's a lot there.
Very briefly. So it's a paragraph.
Yeah, a little footnote. Zimri, commander of half the chariots, assassinated the king, died soon thereafter.
Tell you what, though, if you're gonna like murder the king and take the throne, This is just old school usurping knowledge. You got to make sure that the general is like involved and like on your side.
Oh, otherwise you're just setting yourself up for inescapable failure, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it's going to happen.
Yeah, you needed to conspire with that guy. Make sure that he had the troops on your side. I mean, what are you doing, man?
Yeah, well, you get the feeling he's like, you know what? The king's drunk and I always wanted to be a king. So yeah, I'm just going to take my chance. I really didn't plan this out, but here's what I'm going to do. I can be king for a week.
He might have been drunk too.
But you know, anyone who burns their citadel, chooses suicide by burning the house around them, I think the guy has more problems.
He doesn't seem real thoughtful or stable.
Yeah, a little unstable there in his approach to things. So anyway, that's Zimri. I think maybe, I don't want to say this for sure, but maybe the shortest reign in the Northern Kingdom. Now he gives way to this Omri character who ends up being a significant, probably besides Jeroboam, the most significant king in the Northern Kingdom. And I'll explain why in a second. Let's kind of find out more about him. So picking up with verse 21, it says the people of Israel were divided into two parts. So we did have two parts. We had Omri, general, that the army said was going to be king. And then we had Zimri, the usurper. And now we have two more. Now we have, and so replacing Zimri is now a guy named Tibni, T-I-B-N-I. So that's the two parts. Half the people followed Tibni, the son of Ganath, to make him king, and half followed Omri. But the people who followed Omri, we're told, overcame the people who followed Tibni, the son of Ganath. Now, this makes it seem as if it was like, you know, after a few days, the Omri crowd won out. It wasn't like that. It took 4 years for this to happen. And the way we know that is the way they lined this up with the regnal years of Asa, king of Judah. So I don't want to make it too complicated, but basically it took about 4 years of civil war in the north before the Omri group was able to overcome the Tibni group. So anyway, he becomes king. Tibni dies. This happens in the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah. So Omri begins to reign over Israel. He's got a fairly long reign, 12 years. Six of these, his reign divides in two. Six of these, he reigned at Tirzah, which was the old capital. Then verse 24 tells us that he decided in a sort of a David move to shift the capital. So David shifted the capital to the city of Jerusalem. And this kind of Davidic pretender, we might call him, Omri, he shifts it as well. He bought the hill of Samaria from a guy named Shemer for a couple of talents of silver. And then he fortified this hill and he called the name of the city that he built Samaria after the name of Shemer, the owner of the hill. It's in Hebrew, the word play there is a little more obvious. So our English Samaria in Hebrew is Shomron. The SH and the M and the R, those three consonants are also represented in the guy's name, Shemer, that Omri bought the place from. So Shomron, or Samaria, as we call it, was purchased from Shemer for this two talents of silver. And then Samaria becomes kind of two things. Samaria is now the name of the city itself. So you can talk about the city of Samaria, but you can also talk about the region or the country of Samaria. So sometimes we refer to it as the Northern Kingdom. Sometimes we call it Israel. Sometimes we call it Samaria. All of these are the designation for the same place, the northern part of Judea. So now we have a shift. No longer are the Northern Kings going to reign from Tirzah. Now they're going to reign from Samaria from here on out. In fact, through the very end of the Northern Kingdom when they're destroyed in 722. Now, verse 25 tells us that Omri basically followed the same way. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And we've seen this before. We're told he did more evil than all who were before him. So it's like all these guys are in a competition. We're going to out evil one another. Oh yeah, my predecessor, I know that he was evil. Well, I'm going to be more evil than he is. Verse 26 says he walked in all the way of Jeroboam in the sins that he made Israel to sin, provoking the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their idols. That's that word for vanities again, to anger by their vain idols, their vanities, their empty gods, we might call them. And then wrapping him up, 27 and 28 says the rest of his acts. They are also written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. Omri sleeps with his fathers. He is buried in Shomron in Samaria. And then Ahab, you probably recognize that guy's name. Ahab, his son, reigned in his place. We're going to have a lot of time to spend with Ahab. Now, here is kind of the interesting thing about Omri. That was, let's see, that's verses 21 through 28. So, relatively brief description of the reign of Omri. If you only had the Bible, you wouldn't realize what a significant character Omri evidently was. So, to begin with, and I didn't realize this until I was studying this passage, there's a lot of scholars who think that Omri was actually not even an Israelite. He was probably Phoenician. And the reason they think that is, first of all, with all these other kings, we're told that so-and-so was the son of so-and-so. We're never told that Omri was a son of so-and-so. So there's no patronymic attached to him, as there are with all these other Israelites. What's more, that name, Omri, is not a Hebrew name. But it does match some names close to Omri or Omri themselves that are mentioned in some Phoenician name list. So there's a good chance that he was from of a Phoenician background. Now, why is this significant? Because we're going to hear a lot more about the Phoenicians. That's the Tyre, Sidon area. Because there's going to be intermarriage. There's going to be a Phoenician princess by the name of Jezebel.
Yes.
Who is going to marry Ahab, who is the son of Omri. So if this is true, and it probably is, so Omri's not an Israelite, and that might have been actually the reason why so many were opposed to him. He kind of had this division. Well, why would we want a non-Israelite reigning over us? So it took some time. They didn't just accept him right away.
It is funny, it is kind of funny that you would have like rank idolatry going on, but then also be like, this guy's not even an Israelite. Like, what does it mean to be an Israelite exactly?
Yeah, what does it even matter to you if you're worshiping Baal and Asherah? Why are you worried about making sure you have a pure Israelite as your your leader?
Isn't that sort of what it means to be an Israelite? Is like that?
Yeah, talk about majoring in minors. Yeah. So he's by the Phoenician background, and. So the most telling feature of all this is that Omri is internationally known. So there are two different inscriptions from the ancient world, one from the Assyrians and one from the Moabites, who actually mention Omri. So it's called the Black Obelisk. This is a Neo-Assyrian inscription, and it refers to the northern kingdom as the dynasty of Omri. It doesn't call it Israel, doesn't call it Samaria. It refers to the northern kingdom as the dynasty of Omri. So this is the Assyrians describing the northern kingdom by a name that points to Omri as the founder of it. That's one thing. Then you have what's called the Mesha Stele. This is from Moab, and there's a whole lot to it, but in this particular stele, Omri is said to have captured and oppressed the Moabites during his reign, which points to the fact that not only is Omri shifting the capital to Samaria, but he's also expanding the empire. He's actually going south across the Jordan and south in order to capture Moab and to, no doubt, extract tribute from them. So, and this is a Moabite inscription. So they themselves are describing what Omri did to them. Now, I say all that to point out that this was a significant figure, probably the most impactful and internationally known king of the northern kingdom. And yet, so that's kind of the historian's perspective. And yet the biblical perspective is, yeah, Omri, yeah, he shifted the capital of Samaria, and he was a really evil guy because he engaged in idolatry, and that's really all you need to know. It's a fascinating different perspective. In other words, the Bible's not concerned about what your international accomplishments were as a king, or what you did with regard to the Moabites, or how the Assyrians, they knew you by name, so on and so forth. The scriptures aren't concerned about that. All they want to know is, were you an idolater, or you were a worship of Yahweh? And if you're an idolater, well, then that's really all we need to know about you.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, the only thing that sets him apart, really, in the text of Scripture that we have, is that it just tells you this. It doesn't exactly tell you what it was, but it just tells you that he did more evil than all who were before him. So,
yeah,
that's a lot. But that's
not,
that's
not the legacy you want to leave behind.
Yeah. The most evil. Like, nobody up to this point has done more bad things than this guy.
Yeah, and that it is, you do get this vision as if there is this growing heap of idolatrous trash, and like every new king that comes along makes the heap a little bit higher.
Yeah.
A little bit higher. It just keeps devolving farther and farther into this this idolatrous mess.
Yeah, it's you know, so far we've had like one guy who did not increase the idolatry, but even though he didn't exterminate it entirely, reduced it. It's just one guy. In fact, maybe
one guy.
Maybe you do need to not like exterminate it altogether.
You're gonna need. It's, well, they need a major surgery, and that will be partially offered by the king named Yehu later. But even what he does isn't enough. I mean, the northern kingdom is doomed from the start because they're founded on idolatry. They're founded on the golden calves of Dan and Bethel, and the changing of the calendar, and the change in the priesthood, and this ongoing rebellion against Jerusalem. So they're doomed from the start. Yeah, they're like a mathematical equation that, you know, takes up three pages, and in the second line there's already a mistake.
Right.
Well, that mistake's going to carry through to the very end. I'm not saying that repentance wasn't possible, but until that mistake is corrected, that is, until there's repentance of the idolatry and a return to Yahweh, then yeah, they're doomed to fail. Now, we have one more king that wraps up this chapter, and his name is Ahab, the son of Omri. So the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, so through all this change of kings, assassinations, coups, whatnot, Asa has been the king in the south. You can imagine he's like getting updates. They're like, hey, King Asa, guess what? There's a new king once more over your brothers in the north. So 38th year of the king in the south, Ahab, the son of Omri, begins to reign over Israel. Now, he's got a really long reign, 22 years. And we're told, this is going to be surprising to everyone, so prepare yourself. Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. Once again. And verse 31, I love the way it puts it. And as if it had been too light a thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, like that wasn't enough. I mean, it was minor league sinning. That was way too little to do. As if that had not been enough, he took for him Jezebel, the daughter of Et Baal. So that king himself has Baal's name in his name. Took Jezebel, so she's a princess, the daughter of Et Baal, king of the Sidonians. So she's a princess from Sidon. I mean, we usually don't associate the word princess and Jezebel in the same sentence, but that's who she is. She's a princess of the Sidonians, the Phoenicians. So he did that. He married Jezebel, and he went and served Baal and worshipped him. How did he do this? He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal in Samaria, capital city. So this is the officially sanctioned idolatry in the north. And he also made an Asherah pole. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings who were before him. So that's all of Ahab. Now, there's an interesting tidbit that's added here at the very end, verse 34. So we're talking about Ahab. We're talking about all the things that he did. We're talking about how he worshipped Baal. He worshipped Asherah. He married a Phoenician princess who's going to bring all of her idolatrous trash along with her. And in the midst of all this, how does the chapter end? Verse 34, in his days, that is in the days of Ahab, Hiel of Bethel built Jericho. He laid its foundation at the cost of Abiram, his firstborn, and he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. If you want to look it up, that's back in Joshua 6:26. You might remember the context. after the Israelites destroyed the city of Jericho, the very first city they conquered in the land of Canaan, then Joshua said, he laid an oath on them. He said, cursed before the Lord be the man who rises up and rebuilds this city of Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn shall he lay its foundation, and at the cost of his youngest son shall he set up its gates. So that was the curse that was laid upon the city of Jericho. So why is this verse added to the very end of the chapter? Why is the record of the rebuilding of Jericho and the death of these two sons in fulfillment of prophecy included as well? I think what's implicitly being suggested here is that there's a reversal of the conquest happening. Jericho was the first city that was conquered. And now in this day of the re-Canaanization of Israel, this bringing in of idolatry, this mingling with the nations, the setting up of altars to Baal and Asherah, basically turning Israel into Canaan once more, what do you have? You have a reversal of the destruction of Jericho. That city that symbolized Israel's victory over the Canaanites now is rebuilt as a symbol of the victory of the Canaanite theology over the Israelites themselves.
Yeah, this is more of what we were talking about, where God is looking over this land and it looks more and more like his people have never been there.
Yeah, it's a going back, it's a reversal to the pre-conquest days. Or, yeah, I mean, aside of some Yahweh worshipers here and there, what are you seeing? You're seeing basically Canaanites and Perizzites and Hivites and Jebusites, except they're all Israelites, at least in name. Mm-hmm. They're Israelites according to the flesh, but not according to promise. That's not good news. That wraps up the end of chapter 16. Now, we are going to begin to see some good news as we transition over to chapter 17, because here, after all these kings, this back and forth, we're finally going to be introduced to someone who is going to give us hope, because he's going to be basically the Old Testament John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Who's going to call us back to the Lord.
You know, as right before we get into Elijah here, as you like read through all these kings and you read through all this idolatry and all this provoking of the Lord, which when you read that, like, you know, when you read like this man did more to provoke God than anyone else, like sometimes it almost feels like the provoking, like, you know, in like the New Testament when it says like it tells fathers not to provoke their sons to anger.
Yeah. Right.
In other words, like, don't do things that you know are going to frustrate and anger your children. There's a part of this that almost seems intentional, right? Like, that's not just like a disregard for God. It's more flagrant and blatant than that. It seems more intentional than that you're letting God
very
know
in your face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you go all the way back, and we talked about this, to Saul, when Saul is got to exterminate some idolatrous kings and a bunch of people and a bunch of livestock, and it seems harsh and it seems like, man, that's a lot. And then he doesn't do it perfectly. He keeps just a little, you know, there's some sheep bleeding in the background. There's some cows mooing. They got a king that's captive. And Samuel loses his mind over this whole thing. You read that story, you're like, what? Like, that seems like an overreaction from God. Like, God is super upset about this. Samuel's super upset. Like, is it really that big a deal? Then you read through this list of kings, and you're like, oh, yeah, it is a big deal. Because this is exactly the sort of thing that God was like, this is why you have to get it all out, root and stem.
Yeah, it's one of those 100% fidelity kind of things, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like no wife would ever be happy with her husband being 95% faithful to her. So the Lord is never happy with anything short of that kind of that wholesale fidelity, because he knows exactly where this is leading.
Yeah, and it's not as though Saul is even like not doing it because he wants to dabble in some idolatry. That's not why he didn't follow all the way through. He just was like, it seemed like too much. It seemed like, well, that seems, I'm not gonna go that far. That's crazy. But what God is saying is, like, I don't want any of the ingredients of idolatry laying around lest someone put those ingredients together and we got idolatry again.
Yeah, because it like Paul says, a little leaven leavens the whole lot.
Yeah, you got to get rid of all of it. All the leaven's got to be gone. You can't have it a little bit laying around, even if you don't intend to use it for that purpose. I don't want it accessible.
Yeah. What? And this all goes to the cross, of course. This is exactly why God didn't like reserve a few sins that Christ did not pay for.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if all is not paid for, then none is paid for. If there's still a few sins out there that Christ did not die for, then he didn't die for any of them, because that undermines everything. So like you've said before, I think we were in Joshua, God always deals with sin in its totality.
Right.
He doesn't leave anything behind. Just like idolatry needs to be dealt with in its entirety. So Christ had to deal with all our sins in their entirety as well. So that's a good thing to keep in mind as we wrap up this section about these particular kings. Now, we are, of course, not anywhere close to being done with the kings. We're just going to shift a little bit in our focus as we move into the life of Elijah, because we're going to hear much more about the prophets and what they're doing. It's going to be a kind of a welcome break too. And then there'll be a longer stretch where we hear more about, especially the prophetic interaction with these kings. And one of the themes that we're going to see emerging is the narrative seemed to be designed almost to make fun of the kings, to show their lack of power, to poke fun at the fact they have absolutely no control over the situation, whereas the prophets do. So the kings will be basically lost. They can't do anything to save themselves. And then the prophet will come along, and because he has the word of God in his mouth, he is able to, for instance, cause a famine, or to bring rain, or to give food, or to open eyes of the blind, things of that nature. So there's going to be a repeated emphasis upon the fact that these kings, powerful though they seem to be, and powerful though they think they are, in reality hold no power. All the authority is going to be wrapped up with God, Yahweh, who then is embodied in and represented in these prophets who speak in his name.
Yeah, and it seems like that you have this inserted in here so that you know that God is not simply reacting to things, but he is actually doing things as well. Because you read this list of kings and you're like, man, God's in this mode right now where he's just reacting to everything that man is doing, which is not entirely true, that God is actually doing things, and you get to see that more clearly in the prophets, that God is like up to something.
Yeah. He's not just a reactionary deity. He's the one who's going to be using these prophets in order to steer history in the direction that he wants it to go. So let's at least kind of get a feel for what Elijah is like. We don't have a lot of time to introduce him, to get into his story. But his name, by the way, we say it Elijah, but it's Eliyahu in Hebrew, which is a very cool name because it means Yahweh is my God, which is just, if you're going to bring a prophet in who is going to call people out of idolatry, what better name than Eliyahu? Yahweh is my God. So Elijah, or Eliyahu, the Tishbite of Tishba in Gilead, said to Ahab, so this is a direct prophetic address to the king, and that's not unusual. You're going to see these prophets are, they have courage. There's no hesitation for them to be right in the face of the most powerful person in the country and to speak words to them they don't want to hear. So Elijah says to Ahab, as the Lord, as Yahweh, the God of Israel, there's a little reminder as to who he is, as Yahweh, the God of Israel, lives before whom I stand, neither shall there be dew nor rain these years except by my word. Now that is, that's such a direct insult, not just to Ahab, but to the God that Ahab worships, because Baal was considered to be the God of the skies, the God of clouds, the God of weather, the God of rain, the God of fertility. So for Elijah to say that there's not going to be any rain, there's not going to be any dew, is basically to say, whatever you want to say about Baal, in essence, he is nothing. He's a non-entity. He's a dung deity. He's an empty God, because he's not going to be able to affect whatsoever any of those conditions that are ascribed to him. He's not going to be able to give you any rain until, no rain is going to come until I speak my word.
Yeah, I like this, as the Lord lives too, because they've been living as though God does not exist. And it seems that Elijah said, hey, you're about to find out that God's not dead.
Yeah, that God that you thought you put in the grave and erected a statue of Baal over the top of that grave, guess what? Yeah, he's still alive. And he's about to remind you that he is not only alive, but he's very much at work through me in order to call you back from this path that you've gone down, back from the path that the whole nation has gone down, back to himself. And we'll see this most obviously in the Neo-Sinai move, where you have this competition between Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, where Elijah says to them, basically, why don't keep limping between these two opinions? So don't be a half worshiper of Yahweh, a half worshiper of Baal. It's an either or. It's not a both. It can never be a both, because God is never the God who's going to share his bed with another deity. It's Yahweh and Yahweh alone, or not Yahweh at all. Yeah. So that's where Elijah is going to be taking us. And along the way, as we'll see in the rest of chapter 17, God is going to use him through some individual instances, such as feeding the widow and being fed by God in the wilderness. Elijah is going to become kind of a representative of Israel as a nation. So what God does for Israel, what God does for Elijah, he wants to do for all Israel if they will only repent and come back to the worship of him.
All right. Well, we have run out of time. We will next week get a break from, you know, just talking about Kings, and we will get into this character of Elijah, which is going to be a pretty interesting narrative. So I'm excited to get into him. But we will have to wait, Chad. I'll see you next week.
All right. See you then.